Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography today. Out of the Frame acknowledges the people of the Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation, on whose unceded lands we record each episode from. We respectfully acknowledge ancestors and elders, past and present. It was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. My guest today is Emma Phillips. Emma is a photographer and researcher lecturer in visual communication with the University of Canberra. Her work is focused on the ways that image making might be informed by classist, sexist, and gendered assumptions, and uses photographic methodologies which foreground the representational experiences of women and non-binary people. Emma has 12 years professional photography experience in Australian media design and advertising, and 8 years experience teaching in photography and visual communication programs across Melbourne, Sydney, and Canberra. She recently completed her PhD on the intersection of sexy selfies with class and has been a finalist in the National Photographic Portrait Prize. Emma is currently researching the cultures of online self-representation of elite female and non-binary athletes. Thank you so much for coming today. It's really lovely to have you in the studio opposite me to have a chat. I'd love to jump straight right in and ask you why photography and how you got started.
Yeah, thanks, Pia. Hi, it's actually really, really lovely to be here. It's good to be back in Melbourne, back at RMIT, having good chats with you. Why photography? I kind of love telling this story because when I left high school, I went straight to university to do the general BA arts humanities thing because I had no idea what I wanted to do. And somewhere in the middle of royally failing at that, I found a thing called a leisure course in photography. Literally, there was a poster.
A leisure course.
There was a poster on a wall, and it was the old black and white darkroom printing and processing, you know. And I had done a little bit of it in high school, but not much. And I did this thing, and I was like, the first time that image appeared under the chemicals.
Magic,
isn't it just
right?
A delight? Yeah, it's like actual magic happening in the room. I was like, what is this witchcraft I want in?
Totally.
So that was the start of it. That was a very long time ago. And I managed, of course, to drift around to many other things before finally coming back to photography when I got together with a partner who said, you know, you love this thing. You should seriously do it. So that was the kick I needed and ended up at RMIT TAFE and, you know, did the diploma. And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, wow. And was that transition of kind of going, oh, actually, this is my thing, like from that partner, I had a very similar thing. My husband was like, this is what you do in all of your spare time. Maybe you should do it more.
Yeah.
Did that really kind of give you that appetite or that kind of moment, not only just to go into study, but then to like present yourself out in the world as a creative photographer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know that thing where, I don't know if it's the same for you, but it takes a while to see yourself as a photographer and as a creative person in the world. I just knew I loved doing this thing. I loved looking through the lens and putting frames around things and then making these beautiful prints in, well, sometimes beautiful, sometimes not, in the darkroom. But I didn't really see myself as that creative, I guess.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, until at some point I did, and there was a tip. I can't even tell you, but there was a tipping point where I got it and I could say I was a photographer, but it took me years.
Yeah, I have to admit I still sometimes struggle to say I'm a photographer because I have a visual art background. So it's like I'm a visual artist and photographer, you know, like. So what did you photograph then? Like what was it seeing that after study that you went, okay, I'm going to photograph that?
After I finished my studies?
Yeah.
RMIT, I was really into portraiture. I think it's just a general curiosity about people. I just really love people. And that made it easy to ask them to be in front of my lens. You know, and I used to do this thing in the couple of years after I finished studies, I was assisting, and I was very lucky to be in a studio in Melbourne that was doing lots of great things and, you know, use their gear and assist as well, get paid for it.
Yeah.
And I would often be, you know, sitting on a tram or something and look across at someone who just had this great face. And I'd sit for 5, 10, 15 minutes plucking up the courage to go up and say, hi, this is going to sound really weird. But will you come into the studio and, you know, be a subject for me? So, and I think everyone said yes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Once they get past that initial, like, what are you trying to sell me? Or, you know, how much is it going to cost me kind of thing? and I give them an email address and we talk about it. And yeah. So
that's so cool. I don't think I've ever really done that.
Yeah. I don't do that much anymore, but I was kind of obsessed, if I'm honest. It's a bit embarrassing to admit it, but I used to like lose sleep because I was thinking about photography all the time.
Oh, my God, that's so great. And then were you working in film then or digital?
So the first couple of years of assisting, it was film, and it was right at that digital crossover point.
Yeah.
So the photographers I was assisting were doing a lot of like architectural work on beautiful 6x4x5 film, and I was cutting it up. But that disappeared really fast when the good cameras came out. So digibacks came in pretty quickly.
Yeah. And was that what you were shooting with when you did those portraits?
Yeah, it was both. So I had this lovely Mamiya RZ67, which I still got. I haven't used it in years.
But this is like gold.
Yeah,
right?
It just sits up on the shelf and I just admire it, you know. I really remember halfway through my studies at RMIT, the school got a 3, I think, Kodak Digital, whatever they were called back then. And they were like $15,000 each, you know, 20 years ago. And they kept them under lock and key, like outside of the regular store area in the staff area. And it was only certain students who could like beg for them and maybe get them, you know, and then it was like with its sort
it's
of
like
tongue
using
wag
a
as well.
Word now.
And I look back now and think, God, they were such poor quality really compared to what we have. So, yeah, so I shot both. So I was right in that spot where we went from film to digital.
The reason why I ask is because in terms of process of that thing of going, hi, I'd love to take your portrait. Then you organize the session. And then, you know, it's not like, I think there is a slowing of that and kind of purposefulness that is seen in that kind of like method. Mm. Whereas, you know, nowadays, I mean, I'm constantly taking photos on my phone. So you just snap moments and then you're like, oh, but actually I want to make that a, you know, a decent photo in my head.
Something more considered.
So, yes, you know, that has more pixels and that I could do something with. But in film, I always, because I started in film too, there was just, I guess a slower, considered, like I have to make every moment count and, you know, this is my role of film. Mm. And I've got students now doing things like going back to 4x5s or like to slow down process.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really interesting kind of cusp moment of like having that knowledge of the film process into digital, but also having a very kind of organic, instinctual approach to like, I love that face.
Yeah.
I really want to, you know, keep that face.
Render that face.
Yeah, render.
Forever.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And it's quite generative, really. Mm. Yeah. Do you think that's something that has kind of been a through line through all of your work?
Interesting faces and like hassling people on trains.
Well, sure, but I meant more like rendering something, you know, that is powerful in like humanity.
Oh, totally. I think that's such a great question. Let me think on that a minute. I think there's something in, you know, we throw this line around about photography that there's a power in photography, you know, and I really stopped one day and thought about that. I can't think what it was that I'd shot, or maybe I'd seen somebody else's work that was just having such an impact on me. It was really deeply moving me. And I'd gone through a period of thinking, this medium is a bit limiting, actually. That the two-dimensional thing it creates is limiting. It's beautiful, but that's it. I can't move around it. It's not going to the next frame, you know. And I wanted to tell more of a story. And then I saw this image and I thought, wow, okay, that's just completely arresting, you know, and there's this power that photography has. So I guess it is a through line for me, the kind of combination of curiosity about people and their stories and what stories their faces can tell, you know, and I'm always trying to pull back a layer or two, even in my commercial work. I did a hell of a lot of portraits. That was my thing. And even in that world where it's all structured and it's often about selling something, even if it's selling the cult of celebrity or something like that. Yeah. You know, there's a veneer, right? But I found myself often working with people who wanted to pull back that veneer as well. So it was a really lovely exchange or a really beautiful thing to go there with others who are prepared to do that. And I still got that. I think that's the rub, you know?
Yeah. Can we talk about that commercial sense of taking portraits? Because you've done a lot, like, and I, yeah, assume lots of studio shoots, lots of art direction, lots of advertising. What's that? Is there, I mean, there has to be a buzz. I know there is in that kind of environment and the brief and the outcome and, you know, seeing your image on a massive billboard or in a magazine spread or whatever. But can you kind of maybe talk us through how you go about doing a big commercial shoot like that to find that really intimate, vulnerable moment with your sitar?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, great question again. You know, it's one of those things you can't, I guess, throw a blanket over because, of course, the jobs are different,
totally,
right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about the difference between an advertising job, for example, for like a bank. You know, I'm embarrassed to admit it.
No. We all do our, we all need to earn
our price, right? Yeah. And, of course, it's heavily constructed and it's designed by a creative director. And I almost feel like we're not just technicians, but almost. I actually think of myself as a tradie in that sense. It's like, here's the thing you've got to put together and fix and you go and do it right
now. Also, not the high-vis.
Not the high-vis. Sometimes there's high-vis involved. That's cool. I like that. I feel like I've got a real job then. Hard hat, you know.
Yeah.
And of course you get to be creative with that. And if you've got a good relationship with art directors, then you can have that two-way conversation about what it's going to look like. And, you know, they might shift and change on their original idea, but it is very structured. And I think you're really expressing, you know, high level technical skill, right? Mm. Versus something like, I did a lot of editorial shoots and I preferred them. They didn't pay as much, but I certainly preferred them because you had more creative freedom. So one that stands out, the guy Gotye, you know, the singer, he did the thing with Kimbra. I shot him for Rolling Stone once and he came into the studio in Collingwood, and often with these kinds of shoots, you get like half an hour to shoot the person, you know, maybe a bit longer if they're being styled up.
Yeah.
And he came in, it was just he and I, there was no like entourage of people.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it was, you know, brought his drum kit, 4 hours worth of sitting in the studio, a couple of coffees.
Wow.
Good conversations, a chance to get that, build that trusting relationship. And then he was, you know, there for the sort of taking down the veneer a little bit, you know. So that's kind of what I'm looking for. And how do I prepare for that? I guess it's that thing you often hear with photographers. It's about setting a scene that's going to make that person feel as comfortable as possible. And again, whether that's advertising or editorial, how can I make this person feel comfortable? And I think also them getting to know me a little bit, like really just breaking down what the shoot's going to be. And I will come out from behind the camera as much as I can. Like I've got a tripod and a camera and I will just get rid of that barrier as often as I can. There's certainly a limitation in that. So, yeah, it's the old build trust stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember hearing Annie Leibovitz quote for some masterclass thing where it's like, you know, I don't make the subject comfortable. And I was like, I'm pretty sure we all do.
Mm.
You know, we might do it differently, but there is something, I think, about asking them to like reveal themselves, go on the journey with you, whatever it is. And through some of these interviews that I've been doing for the podcast, it's been fascinating to hear different people's way of doing it.
Right.
I remember when I did a shoot once, everyone's like, oh, so what's the music we're playing? I'm like, oh, I don't play music. And they're like, oh, can we? And I'm like, sure. Like I was like, but I haven't got the speaker. Like it's not my thing. Like I have a conversation.
Mm.
And I love that idea of, as the photographer, because you do have the power, right?
Mm,
it is
absolutely
really tricky thing of like, and if there's lights and flashes and stuff, like it's such an artificial, intimidating environment, right? I hate being on the other side.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there is something about communicating that you're okay, you're in safe hands, I think. Ethically too as well in a way, like
for
you're caring for them. But I know that isn't everyone's MO, you know.
Yeah.
If you were to stay with that idea at the moment with people, because I'm also a people person, so I'm always fascinated to hear about how other people photograph people. Do you think there's a signature like Emma style?
Yeah, there probably is. I don't know that I could express what it is, but I know that there is because people tell me.
In the terms of the way you conduct yourself or the images?
That's a good question. Yeah, both, I guess. So in terms of the way that I conduct myself in shoots, I've heard enough now of people say, oh, you're so calm when you're shooting.
Oh, nice.
And it's so funny when I hear it because I'm like, if you had any idea how fast my heart was going right now, you know, that whole duck underwater thing, whatever it is, it's totally that. And I'm just having inside freakouts, but I'm just a calm exterior.
Oh, my God. Can you teach me how to be like that, please?
I'm just like, oh, my God. So there's that. So I guess that's, it's good to hear that. I suppose that's the kind of environment you want to create. And in terms of the style, yeah, look, I suppose there's, you know, I went to TAFE where it was heavily commercially oriented and I wanted to be Annie Leibovitz back then. I was very clear that I wanted to do those kinds of shoots.
Yeah,
she was doing so heavily, heavily influenced by that. And so there's lots of that kind of, for lack of a better description, I guess that advertising-y look.
Yeah, yeah, you know? That smooth, slick, yes, right, like smooth, highly slick. Produced.
Yep. Edged highlights on faces, you know.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's a phenomenal at work.
Yeah.
Like cool
she
locations.
She is
one of the gods.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a point, I don't know, when I maybe 8 or 10 years ago where it shifted. Like visual culture, I think, shifted away from that highly constructed thing.
Yeah.
To wanting, and I loathe this word because it's so loaded, but wanting something more authentic, you know, more DIY. And it probably coincided with everybody having smartphones, I guess.
Yeah.
And so the aesthetic just changed to, you know, at that point of view thing, a real lack of detailed lighting and I keep saying constructed, but that's really what it is. And I was like, oh, shit, what do I do now, you know?
I also feel like actually, and that's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought about it in terms of smartphones, but I also feel like I see a real sensibility of the 90s coming back at the moment.
Yeah.
Not just fashion, but in terms of photography. And there was this kind of like, I'm just going to make it really obvious where the light is.
Right.
You know, there's no hiding anything. It's not polished anymore. It's like, oh, yeah, there's shadow. Like, or I'm going to use the like point and shoot camera because that has an interesting grainy aesthetic to it. Or, and I feel like there is a sense of performativity but also authenticity around that. So it's like I'm not going to hide everything. I'm not going to Photoshop it to the nines.
Yep.
This is just how it came about. And part of me, I think because I love the Annie Leibovitz moment, kind of goes, oh, really? Like
No polish.
No polish?
No finish.
But I think the draw card for that as a consumer, as someone that, you know, we're always looking at images, is that it's not trying to be something else. Mm. It's just talking to the subject. Yeah. And there is a kind of really, authentic, honest way that it's telling its story.
Yeah. 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 I can't argue with that. It's, you know, it's lovely. I like looking at it. So
yeah.
I sort of wish I could shoot a bit more like that.
Yeah. Oh, I can't do it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I make everything look pretty. I've had to
Which
learn.
It does, by the way. Your photography is incredibly pretty.
Well,
it's beautiful. I love your work.
It's been one of those things, though, where it's like it's also been a downfall for some people, you know. But I'd be the same with your images. Like they are really schlick. They are incredibly defined and strong. And I guess, you know, why I was asking about the Emma style was about mainly about how you conduct yourself. But also you do have – I know we all hate it, but like we have an aesthetic.
Yeah.
You know, you have a draw that kind of goes, this is my thing. This is how I make images. And you see it, see one of your images and you go, yeah, that's it. Like, and I think for me actually is, as in the draw card to your work is I always feel like I'm actually getting something out of the image. So I'm doing the thing that you want to do, you know, like I feel really close to them, and it's partly, you know, the framing and all the kind of things that your tools, but I connect, and that's really hard. You know, yes, it's telling me a story, yes, it's giving me all those things, yes, it's stopping me anyway, but I actually connect to your subject, and that is the critical thing that is important to portraits, but is specific to your work.
It's really lovely to hear you say that. And I have Pleasure. To be honest here and say that I've just taken like a deep breath as you've said that. I've got this little, you know, it's sort of bubbling up vulnerability.
Yeah.
I'll be like totally calm on the outside. And the reason that's happening, I think, is because I worried for a long time that the work that I do sits in that kind of artificial territory, which I've never been opposed to. There are stories to be told through artifice. You know, there are political statements that can be made through artifice. So that device in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. But maybe with that shift in culture and aesthetics back to something that is more immediate, DIY, whatever language we used, made me fear that it was too artificial and therefore actually not able to connect with the viewer.
Oh, I see.
You know, so hearing you say that you connecting is like, oh, that's so lovely. It's actually nice.
Yeah,
I think you should take it.
Like I guess that's probably why I said it is like that thing of like my images are beautiful and I've had to kind of own that. Like that's my aesthetic.
Yeah.
And actually hopefully people get more out of it than just going, oh, that's a beautiful picture.
Mm.
But also that's not bad, having a beautiful picture a highly produced, you know, as you say, like there's artifice thing, there's performativity, there's prop, there's costume, there's all these things, makeup, whatever. But like they build the story of your portrait.
Yeah. Yeah, they're devices, right?
Yeah,
communicate whatever it is you want to communicate.
Yeah, so I'd say lean in.
Yeah. I'm definitely a fan of, in general, whether it's photography or music or film or whatever you do, I'm a real fan of sending messages through popular culture, you know, and that's not always a popular view in arts communities.
Yeah, or academic ones either.
Not right.
Yeah.
But what a great medium for connecting with people.
Yes.
For sending messages en masse if you want to.
Yeah.
You know? So I had, in my early days too, I had these really heavy duty political ideas that I was trying to get through.
Tell me more. How cool.
Trying to get through these photos and but also like really artificially staging them. You know, like I remember having this guy that he was the lead singer of a hip hop band in Melbourne, actually. He was like 7 feet tall, amazing, beautiful man. And he came in, did some portraits with me. It was, you know, like another on the tram moment. Kind of.
So good.
And I remember wrapping, I cut up this, I mean, it sounds so dumb now, but I was young. I cut up this American flag and kind of twisted it up and then put it over his mouth, you know, with his consent,
obviously.
And photographed that as a statement, like wide angle lens. So it was right in your face. And he had just had the right face for it. And it was a statement about, you know, American silencing of its own citizens kind of thing. I'm not American and I shouldn't be commenting on such things, but that's kind of where I was when I was in my fledgling photography days.
But I think those kind of risks are really important.
Mm.
And I think, yes, we shouldn't all just make grand statements, but we can make educated ones.
Yeah.
And we can make comments that then talk about our own society. You know, and if he was up for it, awesome.
Yeah.
Like, great.
I guess the Pauline Hanson falls into that sort of territory
totally,
as well.
Right?
So, you know.
I think politics is a really interesting topic to talk with photography, as it is a political tool. You know, it's weaponized all the time, you know, but actually using it to talk about your own issues or values or visions of change, of making a difference, I think is really huge.
Mm.
I kind of feel that your work moving from portraits or taking portraits with you then shifted focus a little bit, moving into your PhD, but also the kinds of people you started to represent in your photographs. That had a very strong kind of feminist gender kind of values. I'd love to talk a bit more about that.
Mm. Yeah, okay. You talking PhD or generally?
Well, generally. Any of it.
Okay, yeah.
So, I think they probably influence each other.
Mm.
So whether or not you want to talk about the PhD first or?
Yeah, I think the PhD might have been a result of a few things that occurred in my commercial world. And you've got me thinking now about when I you know, when I graduated from photography school and I had a good few years as an assistant, and I also in that time was building Folio, just beyond student Folio kind of thing.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and I had a clear like Annie Leibovitz vision for all this weird political stuff I was doing.
Yeah.
Yep. And obviously, you know, I mean, being a feminist since I was like 4 years old and, you know, angry at all the things.
Great.
So that comes through too, right? And I had this kind of clear idea of things I didn't want to shoot and then people I wanted to work with, I suppose. And I ended up with one of my main clients has been Marie Claire magazine.
Wow. Who can I just say, wow.
Well,
that's so cool.
Look, and it's really super privileged. It's been such a joy to work with them. And it's they're often thought of as quite a fashion magazine, of course, but I never really did any fashion work for them. And my fashion stuff was very small. But I did think like they had a reportage section. They called it a reportage section.
Yes, it was
section.
Always at the front. Sorry, yeah. I was a magazine. Like I loved magazines.
Yes, same.
So they always had like a key story and a profile and there was – that kind of front section was always that, was like actual journalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a kind of feminist mode.
Totally. And so I got given stories like there was a woman who was a soldier, an Australian soldier who fought in Afghanistan, came back to Australia with PTSD like so many do, and felt like the Australian government was ignoring the needs of women with PTSD because it was assumed that all the men had PTSD.
Oh, wow.
And she felt like it was a different set of needs for women. So Marie Claire went, yeah, we'll run that story. So then I get the gig of photographing her in her home and hearing this, you know, it's a beautiful thing. So, and another one was a woman who was in, I forget which country, but she got bitten by a tick or had been affected by a tick and got Lyme's disease. So then there was a story about that and that sort of, you know, hidden terror of such a thing. Mm. And those kinds of stories were the kind of thing they'd give me. And another one that really jumps out, which was so much fun, was they did this kind of nutty story about four women who are really successful in their respective careers and asked them if they thought their careers would have been different had they been men. And, of course, they say yes. here are all the ways. Right? And the photographic component of that was to get them in drag. So it was a shot of them as they are, who we know them as. Like Jessica Rowe was one of the participants. Okay. There was a Matilda involved then. And then they do the drag thing over several hours and re-photograph them like that. And so there's this lovely feminist story. It's kind of fun and a bit, almost a bit silly, but definitely a bit silly. But lots of great stuff comes out of that, even just in conversation in the room, you know. Yeah. So there's always this sort of feminist ferment that's going on in so many shoots that I do. And then the flip side of that was a bunch of clients would, I just was getting increasingly frustrated, I guess, with especially advertising clients who were a little bit stuck in, you know, stereotypical gendered stuff or stereotypical racialized things that it was never overt, but it might be that there's a woman and a man in a shot and she's the demure one, you know, too often, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And
I'm in a floaty dress.
Right, you know.
Yeah. Totally. Smiling, dawdling at the children.
The whole bit.
Yeah. And again, none of the, there's nothing wrong with that, but there are stereotypes that we can subvert just as much as we can adhere to them.
Yeah, that's it. And I just felt, I felt limited in my own, I suppose, creative expression or political desires for things. You know, They're paying me. I can't say a lot. But it was frustrating. And I started to get more and more interested in critiquing the industry, you know, our visual world, than in continuing to shoot ads in that way. So I'm sort of careful at how I say that now because I was very, I was a little bit careless perhaps in years past, kind of going, oh yeah, I got, you know, tired of client requests for this and that and sort of bailed from it. Because actually there were some amazing clients like the Marie Claire's of the world. And I guess what I wanted to say was that early stuff coming out of photo school and having these political sensibilities and feminist sensibilities, I wanted to make that, I wanted that to get into my work as much as I could. And it did. Yes. It often did.
Okay.
You know, so that's that idea, I suppose, of having a relatively clear vision of, you know, what you want to create in the world. And I wanted to be as, like, my own style or creativity be as present as possible in the commercial spaces. So maybe people could recognize the style that I had or, oh, you know, that's Emma who does the, she's the feminist one or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
we'll get her on. Oh, yeah, so I've been the cultural identity chick
for
years.
There you go.
Yeah.
And it's a double-edged sword, right?
Totally. But I actually think, and maybe this is with age, that there is an importance to having that, you know, and we code switch all the time.
Yeah, totally.
We are so good at just making ourselves bigger or smaller or whatever it might be to fit in, belong, be part of the boys' club, yep. get the job,
yep.
get the next job. And again, all of that is valid, but when we can, I think, and again, it is with age and reflection, a lot of reflection, bringing in the things that we care about into our work all the day, like every day, as much as possible maybe,
yep.
is so much more rewarding.
Yeah.
And I think we then get to have a great time. People actually really value the work and, as you say, that vision and more of Emma
mm.
in all aspects of it. And I guess maybe we're taught not to.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And so when we do it, it does feel like we have to, yeah, go with the art director because he's, yep. you know, he's got the, we've got the gig and we'd like the next gig. And instead of pushing, we opt out.
Mm.
So, you know what I mean? Like, and again, I hope it's different for the generations, you know, coming forward. But I think we're constantly trying to be more authentic.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work.
Doesn't always fly. You got me thinking about that. I remember a couple of lecturers when I was studying were really insistent about how kind of fickle the Australian industry is
okay.
too.
Yeah.
And in the sense of you have to be an everything kind of photographer.
Oh, yeah, you have to be able to do it all, right?
Yeah, you can do the car shoot, the bottle shoot, you know, the people, whatever.
Yeah, food, yeah.
And it was like they were serious in that messaging and I just sort of never really took it on and maybe to my detriment, but I just was like, no, I'm going to be Annie Leibovitz, right?
I love that you just had this like, I'm going to be a feminist, yeah. political Annie Leibovitz. I love it.
Yeah, for better or worse.
yeah, but I'm the same, you know, and I think I've had a few conversations with people, maybe one of them was with Shannon McGraw. I was like, I can't do architecture. I'm terrible at interiors and I'm not getting up at like 5 a.m. to watch the sun rise. Like, kill me now,
yeah.
you know. right. I'm not a morning yeah. person. I also don't do weddings or babies or like
yeah.
there's – actually, I've like made it really tiny yep. and very specific about what I'll take photos for.
But that's a strength, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think originally I just probably was in a privileged position where, mm. you know, I had other jobs going or, you know, whatever it was. I did everything initially yeah. and just – but I think I realized that I just wasn't very good at those things because I didn't care enough about it.
Yeah.
Like I could not do a Pepsi ad.
Yeah.
Because I don't drink Pepsi. Like, you know, like – and maybe that's my personality. And again, detriment to like it's a good and a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, I probably could have learned a whole lot of skills that I don't have mm. if I had pushed myself to do that. And maybe that's what when you know you assisted and you try and you I don't know. But I'm lucky to have the career I have, you
yeah.
know. And I do a really, really niche thing now.
Which is a joy, right?
Oh my God, yeah.
yeah.
And like I miss it if I don't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess you're right that there is a privilege in that, right? Like we do no shade on what you do whatsoever. It's just that I'm reflecting myself.
Yeah,
on
that's
you as
right.
well, thinking how lucky I've been to be able to shoot in this relatively narrow way, you know,
yeah.
and probably.
And get paid for it.
And get paid for it. And
yeah.
get paid for it. It's an amazing thing, you know, and I'm kind of rejecting in some senses what those lecturers said about this,
mm.
the need to be in everything and every man they would have said something like that.
Yeah, no.
You know, right. And just kind of go, no, I'm going to find my way with my own thing.
Yeah.
And it is.
It kind of takes more courage, I think.
I think it does, yeah. And I would say that kind of carefully because I'm reflecting on the fact that when I started my photography, I was fortunate enough to be living with my parents for a couple of years to set it up. You
totally.
Know? And so things like that is not available to everyone and that's kind of been the difference, I think.
Yeah. So then how from there – did you get into the PhD?
Yeah, okay. So that point I made before about just getting a bit tired of some of the client requests, and I was probably, you know, alongside that, the way that I was shooting this style you talk about, I was getting bored by my own style as well. And every time I'd go to a shoot, well, maybe not every time, but often, I'd set up the same lighting because I know that it works and, you know, maybe I'd add a gel or something this time,
yeah.
right? But
yeah.
You just and I'd come away with clients who were really happy with it and, you know, it's good, right? But
yeah.
I was feeling really unsatisfied where that was giving me loads of thrills in the years that preceded it. It wasn't anymore. And of course, the obvious answer is to go, well, just change what you do. Like, you know, learn some new lighting techniques, babe, you know. but I just couldn't find the creative drive to do that. And maybe I was just tired, I guess. There's a lot of, you know what it's like. It takes a lot out of you. So I've been running my own business, you know, for years, and I still loved it. Don't get me wrong. I've never had a moment where I've disliked photography, but it was just a bit tired. That's the word I would use. And I couldn't find the new avenue. So then I was teaching just sessionally at RMIT photography at the time and loving that, having that great student interaction, and because they're inspiring.
So learn so much.
Oh, yeah. Totally. And colleagues at the time were like, you know, you should think about your PhD. And I don't know if you had this happen to you, but you know, the first time someone suggests that, and like, I'm not going to swear on the radio, so to speak, but I was like, no, what are you talking about? You
know? Oh no, I didn't even have that. I was like, I don't think I can. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
I'm not qualified.
Yeah, I didn't know either.
Like, what?
Yeah. And of course I don't think we had any role models at the time, because no one in photography does a PhD, right?
Well, definitely not coming from a commercial stream.
Like,
why would you?
Yeah.
Yes. I think that is, and I think for me, I had to really put on like my fine art hat. Because I came from visual arts, it kind of makes sense. But still, I was like, but I didn't do honors, and I didn't, you know, like, I've just got all these years of taking photos.
Yep. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've got a nice folio, but, you know, nothing I can
Am
do.
Am I qualified?
Yeah.
Am I smart enough? No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that sort of tired thing I was talking about, as in a shitty relationship at the time as well.
It's always the way. It's like, let's blow everything up.
It's like, let's blow it. Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah. had a time of having to, you know, recover from the blow up, and then got into honours, fine art honours at RMIT, in fact, and that was the new path. And
amazing.
Yeah, and it was just invigorating. It was like, and it was a whole new world that was a real challenge, because it was going back to study, which I hadn't done in a long time, was a challenge. But, you know, new people, new minds, new things, new creative ways of being. And then that led to me doing the PhD, and I started to open photography books again. I started to go to exhibitions again.
Yeah,
I picked up the camera more often, even if it was just my phone. It was like looking at things in a way that made me feel really good about photography again. So, you know, I really remember very well when I got into RMIT TAFE back in the day, and Mum said to me, Mum's been very supportive. She said, oh, look, I think it's great that you're doing this, you know, but how are you going to get a job, of course?
Yeah.
And I was like, Mum, I really actually don't know, but I know this is
what you need
totally
to do.
The right thing.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a similar thing. It was like it was a career shift. Even though photography was at the center, it was definitely a career shift, and I couldn't quite see how it was going to work out, but I knew it was the right thing again, you know?
Yeah.
And that just that having that like being reconnected with the thing I love so dearly, that's been such a creative force for me, was a very beautiful thing. So, yeah, so that led to my PhD, and now I'm, you know, working as an academic. Who knew this could happen?
I know, right? Me too. High five to you.
Right? Look at us commercial kids go.
Totally weird. What are we? Nope. I think it's really great to map out that trajectory also. And also I love what your mum said, because she probably then thought, why are you throwing away photography and doing a fine art on it? Like, you've got it. You actually made it,
Emma.
Right? Yeah. Like, what? I think, though, what I'd love to hear from you is maybe the content of the PhD. Like,
oh,
I think some of the work that you have done is, for me, is really inspiring. And I talked a lot about, I probably came to the feminist thing a bit late.
Mm-hmm.
And very much around having a daughter and all of a sudden being a mother and modeling and having the guilt of, you know, working and mothering and all that kind of stuff. But also recognizing that actually my whole practice is based on like really strong feminist ideals.
Yeah.
But it's taken me a while to get there, where I feel like, it's really strong and blatant and open and raw in your work.
For better or worse.
Yeah, but like that's inspiring.
Right. Okay.
Do you mind talking a bit more about the content?
Yeah. So how do I start?
Well, maybe the topic. What was your topic?
Yeah, cool. All right. So it's called The Aesthetics of Sexualization. And this was the idea of tapping into the sexualization debates. So all that stuff around, you know, young girls being hypersexualized to young and a kind of hypersexual culture that, you know, women feature in, right? Because basically, we ascribe morality onto the bodies of women, but we'll come back to
that. Totally. Yes.
So the project was, and this you know, this is, when did I do this? 2000, just before COVID, I guess, was my PhD, 2018, I think,
yeah,
over a few years, and sort of ended when COVID ended. And I was contemplating a lot the idea of us having phones in our back pockets and how selfies had become the thing. And yes, it's like, you know, this major, I mean, photography over its whole lifespan since the mid-1850s or whenever it was, has gone through major shifts, like technological shifts. And I would put selfies in there as one of them, the ability for us to have cameras with us and just take selfies.
Yeah.
So this was featuring in my mind. And then there's this idea of representation and self-representation, self-portraits that had always been done by photographers, yeah, and, you know, lots of feminist photographers through the 70s and beyond.
Totally.
But there was something different. There's something different about selfies that I think was really in this conversation about class and the way that we assess kind of aesthetic value in images. And I add to that then the idea of sexy selfies. So this was a conversation I had with my supervisor, and we got to this point of deciding that a great project would be to work with women who take sexy selfies. So where their Instagram feed is just full of, you know, tits and ass selfies.
Yeah.
Bathroom selfies, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And approach them and say, I'm doing this project. Would you like to do a photo shoot with me? You can kind of treat it like you've commissioned a professional photographer. Tell me what you want to do, right? And from there, sit down with them after we've done the shoot, look at the photos and do like a compare and contrast with their own images in terms of the kind of raw aesthetics. What kind of markers in the images tell us that something is a professional image versus an everyday image? And then have conversations about how the judgments of those aesthetics are really about class and gender.
Oh my gosh, that is so great.
I hope I've made some sense.
Oh my god, you've made
so much
sense.
It's been a while since I've said stuff about
PhD. I just love it. I just, it's so, but it's still like, I mean, it's relatively recent, your PhD, but like, it's so relevant right now. Like,
yeah,
it's,
I hope
just,
so.
It just feels this issue is not going away. Mm. And the idea of being able to critique that and see, you know, like we were talking about devices before, the different types of devices you're using in taking photos, in setting yourself up versus handing that over to another photographer versus, you know, even I just think of some of the youth culture where they take photos and then they distribute them and then they don't understand the consequences of what that means.
Right.
You know, these are real concerns of young people today.
Yeah, totally. And there's, you know, there's things like sexy selfies that are shared amongst, you know, like between,
yeah,
a couple of people, right?
Yeah.
Who are in a relationship or not, yeah, or whatever. And there's new research that just came out recently actually that talks about how young women are often not too worried about, like they're happy to take their own sexy selfies, share it with,
yeah,
their a partner, friend, whatever's going, yeah, on, against the sort of general view that's like, oh, women must be feeling ashamed of having that. If it gets out to the public or something, they must be feeling ashamed. And actually it turns out they're not ashamed of it. They're now in a state where they're having a go at the guy that's put
that's
it out.
That's telling them, yeah, that they should,
yeah,
be ashamed
but they
of
haven't
that.
Got that self-shame. Yeah, we've still got older generations,
totally,
mass media wagging the finger and saying, well, you shouldn't have done that. You should be ashamed. You know, so,
yeah,
it's talking to that space, I guess. And, but the kind of quick version of my PhD, I guess, like, you know, the lift
yeah,
version.
Yeah.
I always say, if Kate Blanchett took a sexy selfie, we'd all go, oh, it's beautiful. Let's put it on a gallery wall somewhere.
Mm.
But every day Sally Jones, who takes sexy selfie, is a slut, right?
Yeah.
So my question then is, why is that? What is it? And I think there's something about the professional nature of photography, the actual devices we use and the kind of lighting we choose and the compositions we choose that legitimize a particular type of sexiness.
Okay.
That legitimize it. So it's the actual look of something that could sit in the gallery, that could sit in the art world, even if it's a fully naked woman, she's done it herself, whatever, we just go, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
But if it's sitting in so-called lower art form spaces like Instagram or just shared amongst people,
yeah,
then it isn't regarded as highly.
Yeah, so it's totally value-driven.
Yeah, 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 that's right, exactly.
It's value-driven around the technology but also around the distribution form.
Yeah, yep, yep. And I had a bit of a go at, you know, middle-class feminists actually who would sort of look down their noses at women who would take sexy selfies. You know, why would they do that to themselves is the common question,
oh,
right?
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it overlooked so many things. And one of the things is that, like, since the dawn of being able to draw on cave walls or whatever, men have drawn naked women, right? Or, mm-hmm. or painted or photographed naked women.
Oh, yeah.
And we know that
hundreds and
galleries
and hundreds.
Are full of
yes.
images of women,
yeah.
nude, semi-nude, that men yeah. have taken, right? And then we get to a point where women have the ability to take photos of themselves naked or semi-naked or yeah. in a suggestive way.
And have agency over their
agency
bodies.
And we're like, this is not okay. Yeah. Now, I say that, you know, that's know. Oversimplifying
totally,
a lot
totally.
Of big feminist issues. And I get that there's all the, you know, body image stuff in there. There's the idea that the male gaze is present, ever
yeah,
present.
Of course
it is. You know, we're still living patriarchy. Of course the
yep.
straight male gaze is going to be around, right? How do we negotiate that? And that's a question that remains, like how do we as women, as image makers, whether we're taking photos of ourselves or other women, how do we negotiate that straight male gaze under patriarchy? Because I think it's yeah. present in everything we do. I wish it wasn't.
Yeah, totally.
There, you know?
I think so. And I think, you know, that, I mean, there's some amazing books out now that talk about that and dissect it and this idea of, you know, looking at feminist art through the decades and how, you know, some people make themselves not look pretty, other people, you know, like there's just so many different ways of or using the abject or whatever yeah. it is. I don't think we have the kind of answers yet.
Mm.
Like I still think we're all just peddling.
Yep.
But also, as you say, we still live in this society. So how do we, like there's no bubble.
Mm.
There's no way of just, and also I don't think I want to live in that bubble. Like,
yeah.
so therefore, like for me, it's really interesting. I, as someone who makes a lot of self-portraits, you know, I always say this is the safest way mm. for me to ethically and with care create images that I feel are safe.
Yep.
For me, for my concepts and ideas, but also for the viewer, you know. It's also a practical thing too. Like there's all the other things, but it enables me to do it in a way that I feel comfortable and I can feel like I'm in control.
Because you've got control, right?
Yeah, I have total control,
yeah. Yeah.
you know. And to the point now sometimes actually where I really find it hard for someone else to take my photo.
Yeah, right.
Because, not because I don't want them to, but because I'm so self-conscious because I, control freak,
mm.
but I'm really bad at letting that control because I have sculpted out a space for me that feels safe and that I know that I can be in that frame.
Yeah.
And, you know, I gave an artist talk recently and I said, oh, it's all about me, like clearly, but in jest, but it actually is all, you know, like it
yeah.
is about me being in control of how my representation is.
And how awesome is it that you can do that? Like you have,
right?
you
I have the technology
tools, have
to
the
do that. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And I even have like assistants that I will have helped me do it too.
Mm.
You know, I don't think we've always had that. So yeah, like I also have my selfies. Like I take a selfie. I
yeah.
think it's great. Like
yeah.
under my camera, this light looks good. Awesome.
Yeah.
Why not? How great does my new haircut look?
That's
or
it.
This great dress. And there's no, I don't know. I don't think there's a value judgment about that. It's actually affirmation.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we're trying to seek for ourselves?
Yep.
And yes, there's the male gaze. Yes, there's, I think age is part of it and mm. popular culture is part of it and we have to be aware of those things.
Yes.
But you're right. I think the thing that I find, and again, going back to the PhD, this idea of the class aspect,
mm.
the type of distribution model, you know, the technology, you know, and I guess the question then is, how will that change as our technologies change and how these kind of police platforms, because Instagram is policed in the end, you know,
yeah.
you can't show a breastfeeding boob.
Mm-hmm.
Without,
community standards, right?
Yeah, community standards. Right. But you, but this is the thing, but you can see semi-nude soft porn all the time.
Mm.
So do we, is that okay? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. I don't know. I don't have the answers or kind of care for the judgment, but I guess there's a double standard,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know,
yeah.
I'd love to think that we'll see new and more interesting platforms emerge too,
yeah.
that do. And I guess we've seen that to some degree. I mean, you know, remember Tumblr was a great space.
Oh, my God,
for,
yeah, and Flickr.
Yeah, and Flickr. Right?
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
ancient times now. But, you know, what great spaces there were for all kinds of alternative queer visions and, you know, really safe spaces for groups that were marginalised, groups that are marginalised.
Yeah.
And that was such a loss when Tumblr was –
yeah.
The heavy hand came down, you know, it was
yeah.
like a MasterCard, Visa card thing.
Oh, whatever
that's
it
whatever
was.
The,
yeah.
yeah. So, I mean, I suppose when, you know, when these mainstream platforms moralize and, you know, women get hit the hardest, queer people get hit the
always.
Hardest.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, marginalised people.
Black and brown community, yeah, right? That we see some kind of uprising. I mean, that's where it's a funny kind of, I guess, example to use, but OnlyFans comes out of something like that and whatever other offshoots where there can be spaces, you know. I mean, that's pretty mainstream now, but I'm sure there are others that are fermenting away.
Yes. I mean, you only can hope. And also I go back to that point that you made really early on about sometimes though mass pop culture celebrity can be used for good.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And actually by infiltrating these kind of popular mainstream spaces, we can change things.
Yeah.
It might, you know, there's – it's still hard. It's still like combative or, you know, we get censored or whatever it might be, but – hopefully there's still advocacy for change.
Mm.
Yeah. So if you had advice for photographers now, and I know you are a lecturer, so you, like me, get to see amazing people, young people become photographers, crazy people, no, that what do you think is the kind of the key, you know, messages or thoughts or missions that you want to tell them? Like what is it about photography now?
Yeah, it's a different landscape, isn't it, to when we started? It really is. I mean, I sort of take that view that whatever we're confronted with in terms of, I mean, you know, the obvious conversations around AI, right, and how that's going to impact.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get into, you know, we don't know, right? We don't know at the moment. But I'm certainly not opposed to, I'm one of those like fear-mongering, it's going to take all our jobs kind of, you know.
Yeah,
I'm
not
just
in
kind of master
either.
The tools.
Yeah.
So I think if you're starting out, you know, it's about being open to embracing whatever the technology and the culture and the politics or whatever throws at you and being adaptable to that, you know, being open to it. But I think more to the point with, you know, with young people especially, they've just kind of come into this world, this university world, they're 20 years old or whatever they are, where they're on the other side of a pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, and even without that, the messaging, of course, is that you're inheriting a burning world. You're inheriting a burning planet.
Yeah.
Like literally
it's so
we're over the edge, right? It's so bleak. I can't even imagine how bleak that is.
Mm.
And I'm amazed that any of them get out of bed and front up for, you know, three classes that day or whatever. It's like if you turn around and said, I don't see any point to this, I'd understand.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of tapping – well, now I'm going to speak about us. I should speak about them. For them, I think it's about finding purpose in amongst that, right?
Yeah.
Now, what is that?
Great advice.
What is that? I don't know. I've got this colleague who I really admire. He recently told me that he says to his students, I can see that you've all got that COVID fatigue. You went through high school in COVID. I can't imagine how hellish that was for you. I can see on your faces it's not been good, you know. But then he says something like, probably more gently than I would say now, he says something like, but nobody really cares that you went through that. I'm sure mum and dad care. I'm sure people in their lives care. But in the broader sense of when you're entering the industry, nobody really cares that you went through that. So the question then is, what are you going to do about that? You know, and that's a bit of tough love. But I guess it's kind of, yeah. But I also think that there's this energy for, you know, for change. Like they're inheriting this shitty world. But there's also this fantastic, like young people have that fantastic energy.
Oh, my God, totally.
I love it. Like I find it absolutely inspiring.
Yeah.
And they're political and driven and, you know, this kind of conversation about them being like shiftless and lazy is just so far wrong.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
No.
You know, they might be disengaged at points.
Sure.
But like, as you say, why wouldn't you be? Like sometimes you need respite.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would say the students that I come across all have something to say.
Yeah.
They all have really interesting perspectives and lives and their work is kind of urgent.
Yeah, urgent. That's the word.
Yeah.
And I guess I would say to them, you know, if they find a way to connect the things that they're passionate about, like these political, these big, big ideas with the work that they're doing in the everyday as much as possible.
Yeah, that's such great advice.
It's not that easy to do that, but, you know,
oh, sure.
To get the demands of capitalism and whatever
it's
else.
A podcast, it sounds good. No, I think you're right. I think that's but that's inspiring. That gives them space, you know, motivation and, yeah, hopefully a justification to what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, they've probably got mums too going, well, why'd you pick photography?
What are you going to do?
Yeah. So what next for you as a lasting question.
Yeah, okay. What's next for me? Good question. So my academic life is very new. So I've only been in about a year. I mean, I guess I was teaching sessionally before that, but as a full-time lecturer researcher, it's new. So I'm still in the, you know, honeymoon excited phase.
Yeah, great.
And I'm very lucky to be in a role that has part teaching, part research. So my photography, I'm still doing some commercial photography, but mostly it's morphed into research. So I'm in this fantastic place where my university has like what they call a sports pillar, and I'm kind of the sporty kid from way back.
Oh my God, I love it. I was trying to work out how we could bring football. Oh, cool.
Surprised it's taken this long. It's funny, when I landed in Melbourne this morning, I was like on the lookout for all the footy signs. You know?
Yeah.
It's good to be back. So I have somehow managed to find a way to research women's sport through photography.
So
like,
great.
Honestly, I'm like, they're going to find out one day that I'm just pulling the wool over their eyes.
No, excellent.
So tonight, in fact, I'm going to the GWS Giants women's team is playing against Melbourne in Carlton. And I'll go along. I'm working with them in their season as like a documentarian, I suppose. So I'm kind of a fly on the wall of their season. I take a bunch of images at their training, their games, other things. And then I work with about 10 of the players and give them like a cache of images of themselves, and they can do whatever they want with them. Ideally, they put them up on Instagram or TikTok or something. Yeah. And then we have conversations at the end of the season about why they chose, you know, that photo or not that photo. Tell me what your presence on Instagram is like. Are you getting any
So the quality shit talk? Research and data side.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, I'm hoping anyway, it's an area that, I mean, there's a lot of good research going on cyber hate, and especially with female athletes, of course, copying all kinds of awful. Men get it too, right? But there's a particular flavor to it with female athletes and a lot of it. So there's lots of good research from like legal disciplines and health disciplines and so on, which is really important. There's not as much kind of cultural image-based research. So of course my interest is in visual culture and how women, and really it goes back to, you know, this idea that, like, if I say the word footballer to you, you're probably going to conjure a man in your mind. And fair enough, because it's been, they've had
it. Not with you, but
yes. No, not with me. Correct answer. but, you know, it's like that. They've been the ones that have had that social, that's the image socially for 150 years, right?
Yeah.
So if you're a woman who comes into that space and your sport is becoming more public facing, it's in its early days, how do you negotiate your image, like literally either on field, how do you present yourself?
Yeah.
What kinds of, you know, what kinds of shifts and changes do you make to the way that you present that tends to certain stakeholders, for example? And I will always say patriarchy is the number one stakeholder still. They're still fumbling around for crumbs to keep the game going. Mm. So how does that affect the way you present yourself on social media, and what opportunities also exist for you? So, and photography drives the whole thing.
Oh my God, totally. What a great research project.
It's fun. It's really fun. So that's where I'm at now, and I'm hoping that will lead to bigger and better things around talking to like governing bodies and clubs and about how they can actually support female athletes in that aspect of their sporting world.
Amazing. I can't wait. Thank you so much. What a fab conversation we've had.
It's been an absolute pleasure. We should do this every week.
We should. Let's do that. Let's find out how we can do that. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Pia.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leadovitz.